All right, welcome everyone. This is a special taping of Stephen Roberts Live. I have my best friend, Jillian. Hi, Jill.
Hello, Stephen.
Co-host all the time, a lot of the time anyways. And our special guest today is Professor Carl Grossman. I'm gonna read a little bit of his bio here, just for the audience. This is a podcast, by the way. Professor Grossman has specialized in doing investigative reporting in a variety of media for more than 45 years. He teaches as well as practices journalism. He's a full professor of journalism and at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury, where the courses include investigative reporting. For over 20 years, he's hosted the nationally aired TV program Enviro Close Up, produced by the New York-based video production company Enviro Video. He's written and presented TV documentaries for Enviro Video. Some of these include 3 Mile Island Revisited, The Push to Revive Nuclear Power, and Nukes in Space. The nuclearization of weaponization of the heavens. So, welcome to the show, Professor Grossman.
A pleasure to be with you.
I have been seeking many academia and dignitaries to try to push this Fukushima Daiichi. I know you characterize it as a catastrophe, but I more or less characterize it as a travesty.
Mm.
I guess one adjective might be just as good as the next, but Jill, why don't you start us off here?
Welcome, Professor Grossman. I'm very happy to speak with you. I've been reading some articles and some of the stuff that you've written, and there seems to be you're right up with the problem that's going on with the problem with Fukushima and the world not knowing about it. Like, it's just the most secret and silent mess. And I'm wondering why there isn't more public media about it.
Well, it goes way back in terms of the development of nuclear technology. In fact, let me read from a book that I wrote. I wrote the book in 1979 after the 3 Mile Island accident in the United States, and I committed myself to write a book about the reality, the truth about nuclear power. It's called Cover Up, What You Are Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power, and it begins... You have not been informed about nuclear power. You have not been told. And that has been done on purpose. Keeping the public in the dark was deemed necessary by the promoters of nuclear power if it was to succeed. Those in government, science, and private industry who have been pushing nuclear power realized that if people were given the facts, if they knew the consequences of nuclear power, they wouldn't stand for it. And as I've given speeches through now the decades on atomic energy, people would come up to me at these presentations, these events, and say, "I think, Professor Grossman, what's needed here is a catastrophic accident, and then people will understand the reality of things." Suggesting correctly that humanity only moves when a disaster occurs. Well, now there have been several disasters. I mean, 3 Mile Island was... Stephen mentioned the video I did, which is online, 3 Mile Island Revisited. You can go watch it online, where there's a huge cluster of cancer in the area of Goldsboro, Pennsylvania. This is the town where the 3 Mile Island nuclear plant is. And that was 1979, that accident. And then in 86, you had the Chernobyl disaster. And now you have the Fukushima catastrophe, or travesty. I think travesty is correct word for it too. And what the nuclear, it's more than just the industry. It's a nuclear establishment of government officials involved with atomic energy, the nuclear industry, of course, others with a vested interest in atomic power. What they've been able to do, and it's quite amazing, is to, again, the book is titled Cover Up, What You're Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power. They, in the wake of catastrophe, they've been able to cover it up. And they, well, for example, the International Atomic Energy Agency has been in the lead when it comes to the Fukushima cover-up. And what the IAEA says is, and I'm just reading here, no health effects have been reported in any person as a result of the radiation exposure from the accident. In fact, health effects have been reported, lots of them. Thyroid cancer is beginning to appear in Japan. And the claim by the IAEA, by other agencies, international and those in Japan, and of course the nuclear industry, you can count on them. It's just, it's a giant lie. It's sort of akin maybe to the tobacco industry, of the United States saying that cigarette smoking is fine, which they, you know, they claim for years, for many, many years, denying any link between smoking and cancer.
Four out of five.
This is the same sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I've been a journalist all my working life, and I must say I regret that the press hasn't, some of it, a little bit of it, has done some strong investigative reporting when it comes to Fukushima. But basically, the press has just gone along with these deceptive claims, with these lies of those who promote nuclear energy.
Isn't this just a wild conspiracy? This massive cover up.
Well, I try to avoid using the word conspiracy because people kind of think claiming a conspiracy. I think it's perhaps better to describe it as a community of interests. Community of interests. For example, the IAEA was founded by the United Nations, and its mission was to, and I'm reading here, and you can just go to the IAEA's homepage, to accelerate and enlarge the contribution of atomic energy. It was to be an international agency, a mirror image of, in the United States, we used to have the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, which was set up to promote and also at the same time somehow regulate nuclear power. Well, the AEC was abolished in 1974 in the United States because of this being a conflict of interest to somehow promote and regulate. But the IAEA continues, and it's just, if you look at, go to the website of the IAEA, it's just a huge promoter, a booster of nuclear power. And here, disasters occur like Chernobyl, like Fukushima. And, well, with Chernobyl, the IAEA downplayed, said, you might have ultimately 4,000 deaths as a result of the Chernobyl disaster, and this is now the Ukraine, but then it was the Soviet Union. But with Fukushima, it's like zilch, it's zero. They've gone to a giant lie. It's just unbelievable, these nuclear Pinocchios and what they think they can pull off. But it's hard when you get to nuclear. See, radiation doesn't leave a calling card. So as people begin to suffer from cancer and other diseases as a result of the poisons, the nuclear poisons from Fukushima, how are you going to distinguish in 10 years or 15 years from a cancer being caused by Fukushima and a cancer being caused by some other pollutant? And most of cancer, I've actually done a lot of writing in this area, is environmentally caused by pollutants of one sort or the other. Some of it is voluntary smoking, but a lot of it is chemical. or radioactive. So the nuclear industry figures that, you know, radiation is something people can't smell, they can't see, they can, so that you can get away with having a meltdown, and in the case of Fukushima Daiichi, multiple meltdowns, and an ongoing disaster. I mean, the radioactivity continues to stream out of those nuclear-stricken nuclear plants into the air, into the Pacific Ocean, moving with the currents, moving in the fish that ingest some of these poisons. But you know, it's hard for people. It isn't something you can see. It isn't something you can smell, and so forth. So in the first instance, the nuclear industry has that advantage. And then meanwhile, because cancer is kind of epidemic globally, the nuclear industry and the nuclear establishment has a shield there. I mean, in the end, the tobacco industry was brought down. Finally, the relationship between smoking and cancer has been, I mean, this is years ago. The U.S. Surgeon General, in fact, was at long last in the lead affirming this connection. Yes, though, in fact, an independent American journalist, an absolutely wonderful a journalist named George Seldes, S-E-L-D-E-S, he and his journal, which was called In Fact, this goes back into the 1940s in America, wrote about extensively over and over again, while the mainstream media were not, the connection between smoking and cancer. But ultimately, a few decades later, the U.S. Surgeon General came around, and I mean, there was all this documentation for years, and declared the link with radioactivity. That needs to be done. The problem here is these, as I say, these nuclear Pinocchios, and not only are they claiming and have been claiming that don't worry about the radioactivity, it's stuff we can all tolerate, it's not going to cause any kind of health consequences, there's background radiation, this just adds a little bit to it. Yeah, but they don't mention that background radiation does damage too, kills too. But also these characters, talking about going to one's computer and looking things up, Google the word hormesis. You know, maybe later after the show, viewers should Google the word H-O-R-M-E-S-I-N, hormesis, H-O-R-M-E-S-I-S, hormesis. And what that is this absolutely wacky theory developed by these atomic scientists, which claims that actually radiation is good for you. Radioactivity, they claim, exercises the immune system and keeps people healthy. Not only are they in denial that radioactivity is dangerous, but these bums would have us believe that radioactivity is good for you. They're just an amazing bunch of criminals, frankly. Idiots, I mean, I feel those behind the nuclear undertaking should be judged on the principles of Nuremberg for crimes against humanity, because we're not talking about a few people. We're not talking 4,000 people as a result of the Chernobyl disaster dying. In fact, excellent research by Dr. Alexei Yablokov, a noted Russian biologist, and a team of European scientists in this excellent book that was published by the New York Academy of Sciences a few years ago, they come to the conclusion that 1 million people will die as a result of the Chernobyl disaster. And likewise, when it comes to Fukushima, we're talking about a scale of destruction of life of that order. So you're talking about crimes against humanity by those with a vested interest for one reason or the other in nuclear technology. And moreover, and I always want to add this, I mean, certain risks in life, certain dangers in life, you take an airplane ride, or you just drive your car on the highway, and there's a certain risk. But the thing about nuclear power is that it is totally unnecessary. It's just the most dangerous way conceivable to boil water, and solar and wind and the host now of available green renewable energy technologies can provide all the power we need, energy we can live with. Nuclear power wasn't and is not now necessary. It's so destructive, it's so terrible, and it must be stopped.
Well, it seems as though the nuclear power industry actually, oh, there's a bit of feedback there, actually came out of the war industry, isn't it? Like, they first wanted to use plutonium for nuclear weapons.
Yeah, well, the origins of this monster, and I write about it extensively. I would suggest my book, Cover Up, What You're Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power, to viewers. And you can get a free download. You mentioned before about the reluctance of the press to fully cover Fukushima. Well, after the Fukushima accident occurred, or actually began, this is March 11th, 2011, the publisher of this 1980 book, Cover Up What You're Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power, said, let's put out a new edition as the result of the Fukushima catastrophe. And he approached publishers all over, major publishers. He's a small independent publisher. It's Martin Shepard and his wife Judith Shepard, who published my book originally. And they no one was interested. So what he agreed to do was to take a new introduction to Cover Up that I wrote and print it up and put it and the entire book online, available to anybody who would just all you do is go to my website, which is carlgrossman.com. That's Carl with a K, Grossman, one word, .com, and go to books and you'll see Cover Up and you can download the book absolutely for free. And in that book and other writings I've done, also on that website are various presentations and so forth, and you can read all through those. And in all of them, because I think it's very important for people to understand history if we're going to deal with a current nightmare, and how it begins, this nuclear monster, particularly involves the years 1946, 47, 48. You see, the Manhattan Project was this huge, top-secret American effort to build nuclear weapons during World War II, because there was this great fear that the Nazis would build atomic weapons. Fission had been done for the first time in Germany in, this is December of 1938. And so Albert Einstein, from near where I am sitting right now on Long Island, where he used to summer, he and a number of other scientists got together and, over Albert Einstein's signature, sent a letter to President Franklin Roosevelt suggesting some sort of project to really fight fire with fire. Before the Germans developed nuclear weapons, we needed to do something along those lines. So there was this crash program with secret laboratories all over the United States, Los Alamos, in New Mexico, Oak Ridge in Tennessee, what was called the what's now called Argonne Laboratory in Illinois. And by 1945, they had built several weapons. A couple of them were dropped on Japan, on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But the years 46, 47, 48 are very important because the folks, and again, I quote from literature on this, the folks at the Manhattan Project were desperate. What else are we going to do now? I mean, we can continue to build nuclear weapons, and they did, including what was called the super, that would be the hydrogen bomb. This was Edward Teller's project, and indeed a whole new national nuclear laboratory was set up for Teller, Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, to build the hydrogen bomb. Ultimately, tens of thousands of atomic bombs and hydrogen bombs were built, but what else could we do with nuclear technology to really perpetuate our jobs? Hundreds of thousands of engineers and scientists were employed on the Manhattan Project. Importantly, the U.S. government often contracts out its projects, and General Electric and Westinghouse were given contracts during the Manhattan Project to do this and that, and that's how they got into nuclear they ultimately became the Coke and Pepsi of nuclear power, GE and Westinghouse. 80% of nuclear plants worldwide historically are of Westinghouse and or General Electric's manufacture or design. So you had these people with a vested interest, the folks who had jobs with the Manhattan Project or had contracts with the Manhattan Project, which in 1946, January, became the Atomic Energy Commission. What else can we do with nuclear technology? So they looked at schemes. We'll use it maybe to irradiate food so you can eat a strawberry 20 years after it's been zapped, if you want to eat a strawberry 20 years after it's been zapped with radioactivity. Or we can use nuclear technology as power source for airplanes. I mean, would you believe that? But then there was a big problem because they had to shield the pilots from the radioactivity on the early, these were bombers that were built that were to be powered by nuclear power plants, by reactors. Nuclear-powered rockets was a big scheme, and actually I've written a lot about that. And then another scheme was using nuclear devices as a substitute for TNT to blow up big holes in the ground to maybe create new harbors. Indeed, there was a project called the Panatomic Canal. They were going to string 125 nuclear devices across the Isthmus of Panama, blow them all up, and you'd have a new canal without the problems that were faced in the construction of the original Panama Canal. This was finally stopped when the people down there just protest. I mean, there'd be rains, radioactivity would be raining down on these poor people for months, if not years. So that was stopped. And then nuclear power plants. And this was not seen really as primarily as a means of generating electricity. But as you note, nuclear power plants produces a byproduct, plutonium. And plutonium is what's necessary for, well, the Hiroshima bomb was enriched uranium, but the Nagasaki bomb was plutonium, produced at the first reactors that were built. And this is also part of the Manhattan Project at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in the state of Washington. And these reactors were built because when you do fission, it's actually the uranium-238 picks up a neutron and becomes plutonium. Plutonium-239. And the idea was you could use this plutonium built up in reactors to have it as fuel for atomic weapons. Also, in the hydrogen bomb, the trigger is a plutonium trigger. So here in this country, the plan was to build dual-purpose reactors. And it's in all the literature, and I quote it in my writing, to produce plutonium for weaponry as well as a byproduct, generate electricity. I mean, the claim is, in those years even, was the peaceful atom. There never was a peaceful atom. Atoms for war and atoms for other purposes. It's all tied up, two sides of the same coin. Now, there's some who claim that atomic energy, so-called peaceful atomic energy, was promoted in these years, in this period, by scientists who were just guilt-struck by Hiroshima and Nagasaki and wanted to do something useful with their technology. I've gone through the history of this in detail, and it has to do with greed, not guilt. These people wanted their jobs, these companies wanted their contracts, and they pushed nuclear to a fare thee well on humanity as a result of this greed. And they greased their move with public relations. Here in the United States, the art of PR, of manipulating the public, often through the media, began. The PR push on nuclear power from the outset was absolutely intense, and it continues to this day. So we go back to Fukushima and why we're not getting the truth about Fukushima and why you get all this this hogwash. And most of the media, virtually all the mainstream media, just goes along with it, has to do with a very well-honed, very well-designed and very well carried out exercise in PR, manipulating the press, manipulating the public. It's shameful and, in the end, criminal, considering the number of people whose lives will be lost. I mean, tobacco, cigarettes, the millions who have died because of that is one thing. Here you have, here you have a comparable poison in a way, but these poisons are going to be around forever that are being generated, that are being spewed out of Fukushima as we speak. For example, plutonium, which is considered the most toxic radioactive substance. Plutonium has a half-life of 24,300 years, a half-life. That means in 24,000 years, it's half as radioactive as when you start. To figure out how long a radioactive poison has, it's called a hazardous lifetime, how long is it's hot and will destroy life, you multiply the half-life by a figure of either 10 or 20. If you're more conservative, you go to 20. Take the 24,000 years for plutonium, you multiply that by 10, and you're talking about plutonium being around for 240,000 years. I mean, it's a long time if you do it by 20, and really you should do it by 20 because it really takes that long for a radioactive poison to fully cool out. We're talking about 500,000 years. So some of the stuff that's being emitted, being discharged from Fukushima will be around for eternity, killing people, destroying life. Let me just give me a couple of minutes to talk about Admiral Hyman Rickover. He is considered the father of the nuclear navy in the United States, and in fact, he was in charge of construction of the first nuclear power plant built in the United States. It was Shippingport in Pennsylvania, which was a partnership between the Atomic Energy Commission and the Division of Naval Reactors. Ultimately, Rickover, he saw the light. And in 1982, when Rickover retired from the Navy, he gave a speech. And the speech is, I report about it in my books and my work. You can get the whole speech online before a committee of Congress. And what he says essentially is that billions of years ago, when the Earth was in the process of its formation, there was so much naturally occurring radioactivity, the extreme of background radiation, that life couldn't exist. And only when these radioactive poisons went through their half-lives, said Rickover, 1982, was life able to start on Earth. And then he goes on, again, this is Rickover, not Greenpeace, what we're doing by having these nuclear power plants, these nuclear reactors, is recreating the very poisons that precluded life. And there, says Rickover, I think the human race is going to wreck itself. And he goes on, what we must do is outlaw. Again, this is Rickover, the father of the nuclear navy of the United States. We must outlaw nuclear reactors. We must get rid of all nuclear power plants. It's a matter of life and death. So that's basically when Bill Clinton ran for president, the motto was, it's the economy is stupid. With nuclear technology, with nuclear power, it's the radioactivity stupid. There'll always be radioactivity. There'll always be radiation involved with atomic energy, despite the design of any nuclear power plant, whether it's a boiling water reactor or a pressurized water reactor or what have you. And that radioactivity it kills. Some of it will get out. You'll always create radioactive wastes that will be around for millions of years, some of it. A threat to life. This is something that humanity has. It's a dead end for humanity, and we must say to the same to it as we said to chemical weapons after World War One. After the mustard use of mustard gas in World War One and all these horrible chemical weapons in World War One, people said, this can't be, and they outlawed chemical weapons. I mean, it hasn't been a perfect outlawing of chemical weapons. We hear about the Syrians having chemical weapons and so forth, but there's an understanding that chemical weapons are just, it's just a, such a threat to life, and the same thing has to be done with nuclear technology. We must understand that nuclear technology is a threat to life, and then the genie can be put back in the bottle, and it must be put back in the bottle if our grandchildren and their grandchildren are to survive.
And we can't do that as long as there's a marriage between the World Health Organization and IAEA.
Well, that's a very important point, and I've just written some pieces, and actually the reporting was originally done by a very good friend of mine, Libby Halavi, and she has just the finest little podcast called Nuclear Hot Seat, and she interviewed Allison Katz, and Allison Katz, who's with a group called Independent WHO, she used to work for WHO, for the World Health Organization, actually for many years, relates in Libby, and it's L-I-B-B-E, Halevy, H-A-L-E-V-Y. You can Google her name, Nuclear Hot Seat, and then put Allison Katz, and you can hear the whole program. What occurs is that after the IAEA was created, this nuclear promotional operation by the United Nations, the United Nations also created the World Health Organization, which is supposed to be the agency that's going to protect our health. Well, in 1959, the IAEA, which was set up in 57, enters into an agreement with the World Health Organization. Essentially, it captures WHO, and the agreement, which remains to this day, just go to the WHO website, and you'll see it right there. This agreement, which mandates that WHO, when it comes to any matters involving IAEA, which means any matters involving radioactivity, nuclear technology and so forth, must cooperate with, must work with, essentially have its reporting vetted by the IAEA. And as Allison said about this deal, let me get a good quote from, because it's in a number of stories that I wrote in recent times, Allison Katz's remarks. Here we go, right here. Under this deal, says Ms. Katz, WHO cannot undertake any research, cannot disseminate any information, cannot come to the assistance of any population without the prior approval of the IAEA. WHO, in practice, in reality, is subservient to the IAEA within the United Nations families. On nuclear issues, says Katz, there has been a very high-level institutional an international cover-up, which includes governments, national authorities, but also, regrettably, the World Health Organization. Some people think that the issue of nuclear power is just a product of excesses of capitalism, the left often argues, and I am very comfortable with positions from the left. But the left often argues that a GE or a Westinghouse, these corporations, don't give a damn who ends up dead as long as they profit. And the left is right. But what the left has to understand about nuclear technology, nuclear power, it's not just big business, it's big government. In fact, what was created in the United States in terms of the Manhattan Project and the Atomic Energy Commission, which then morphed into the Department of Energy and a Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And there was a different but comparable developments in other countries. A lot of the government part of this involves, again, not sheer profit, but power. And when you get to nuclear, too, it's a kind of a cult-like thing with those involved in the nuclear establishment supporting nuclear power. For example, been many times to Russia in recent years. I wouldn't go now with Putin, though. But in the 90s and the early 2000s, I was in Russia as there was an attempt in Russia with the end of the Soviet Union to restructure the environmental and energy programs of Russia. And I spoke around, in fact, last time I was in Russia, I spoke at a conference on nuclear power in Siberia. And, you know, until the fall of the Soviet Union, you couldn't blame corporations. You couldn't blame GE or Westinghouse for the nuclear development of in the Soviet Union. I mean, which is unbelievable. I mean, I remember the first nuclear plant I saw in Russia was in Voronezh on my first trip. It's built right in the middle of the city. And there's these big, big pipes that come out of the nuclear plant, providing radiation-tinged steam for heat in these, like, Soviet-era apartment houses. I mean, right in the middle of the city. And there in the Soviet Union and in Russia, what it had involved was this big government thing. So it's when you get to nuclear power, it's a little bit beyond your normal left analysis that it's unbridled capitalism and profit-making to the extreme. It has to do with vested interest. Conservatives speak about when government sets up an office, a momentum is begun, and that office attempts to get bigger and bigger, and there's this vested interest, and the conservatives are right, certainly when it comes to nuclear technology. But just furthermore, I mentioned this cult thing. Like I did a book years ago on toxic chemicals and the relationship toxic chemicals to illness, particularly cancer. And the publisher of the book asked, back same publisher who published Cover Up, why don't you go to get some sort of person who worked for one of these chemical companies to explain her or his rationale for it. And I found a fellow who worked for American Cyanamid in New Jersey, the cancer capital of America. And his rationale for having worked at this big chemical company was, look, I had four kids. I had to support my family and so forth and so on. So there it was strictly finances. But when you come to nuclear, I mean, like at the National Nuclear Laboratories, I've heard the scientists describe, here in the United States, I've heard the scientists describe themselves as nukies, sort of like moonies. Again, it's like a weird nuclear cult.
Or trendy.
And I don't know exactly why. Maybe it's the proximity to power. Maybe it's the training they get in the U.S. nuclear navy, working for a utility involved in nuclear energy, working for some of these departments at universities that focus on nuclear physics. I don't know what it is. I'm not hearing anything from, you know, the outside of their very narrow
or maybe
world. But with nuclear technology, I mean, like you take a thing like hormesis, this has to do, I believe, not just with power and money. It has to do with a semi-religious commitment these characters have to atomic energy.
Maybe it's just the money, Professor.
I don't think it's just the money, because if it would be just the money in Russia, or we're talking former Soviet Union, you wouldn't have had the huge I mean, our nuclear program was kicked off by that letter from Einstein, 39, to Roosevelt, got the Manhattan Project. In fact, the Soviet program was kicked off, and I've spoken about this in Russia, by a letter from a physicist in the Soviet Union to Stalin. And it was kicked off. And for example, the last time I was there in Russia was in a city called Tomsk, T-O-M-S-K, in Siberia. And that, until, well, recent times, was a secret city. It was Atomic City, USSR. And there were a bunch of them, closed secret cities where scientists worked on atomic weaponry and atomic power, and there was various installations there in Tomsk involved in the nuclear cycle and nuclear production. Some of the scientists, some of the engineers you know, live very well compared to most Russians. But, you know, I interacted with some of them and have interacted with some of them in Russia. And it's like talking to some national laboratory scientist here. I mean, they live a better life than your average citizen, whether it's a scientist at Idaho National Laboratory or Oak Ridge National Laboratory or the nuclear facilities now in Russia, formerly in the Soviet Union. But you speak to them, it's like, I don't know, I mean, I have nothing against Jehovah Witnesses, but you ever have some Jehovah Witnesses come to your door and you try to have a conversation with them? Like you're talking to zealots. And so when it comes to nuclear, there's some sort of zealousness involved. And again, I don't know the roots of it, but it's not just money. If it would be money, you'd figure it would collapse. I mean, for example, today, nuclear power is completely uneconomical. The folks at Wall Street don't want to touch it. Without loan guarantees, without taxpayer money, the Obama administration wouldn't, as the George W. Bush administration and previously other administrations have tried to revive nuclear power, because for decades there wasn't a new nuclear power plant built in the United States after the Three Mile Island accident. Actually, it began before TMI. It's terribly uneconomical. It's extremely expensive. And a new nuclear power plant costs $13 billion. So what our government has been doing in recent years, because Wall Street has been saying take a hike, what they've been doing is saying we're going to provide billions in loan guarantees. It's an uneconomical form of energy. Always has been uneconomical. So, you know, it isn't...
Well, they call it
isn't just money.
They call it. Can you? Well, I guess this is going to tie into along to what I was going to ask you, but maybe you can speak about the rhetoric about nuclear energy. I've heard that many in the science call it green energy because you're not using the fossil fuels. It's just a plain and simple.
Yeah, well,
deception.
That's a simple piece of baloney. I mean, that's what you have to respond when they talk about. I mean, the claim is that nuclear reactors don't emit, greenhouse gases, and thus, in the face of global warming, we've got to go nuclear. It's green. What they're not mentioning is that in the nuclear cycle, the mining, the milling, the enrichment, the construction of the plants, and so forth and so on. Issues of what, how you deal with the waste. There's plenty of emissions, discharges of greenhouse gases. This is not carbon free. When you look at the whole nuclear cycle, as we should, it's very carbon intensive. What's green is solar. What's green is wind. What's green, you know, these safe, clean, renewable energy technologies that are here today. It's not green, and to go to nuclear because of global warming is it's like substituting heroin for cocaine. I mean, it's not the solution. It's, you know, it only assists and only helps those, as I say, with the vested interest that have put us on this dead end road.
Oh yes, absolutely. I know it's a little bit of a silly post, but I seen it this morning before before I called you, and there's a congressman or something that's talking about nuclear energy, and well, as you happen to mention, the president said that he was going to still try to push for more nuclear building, and this congressman actually said that wind turbines will slow the air down, and this will increase the heat of the planet. It will increase global warming. That is almost a 3-year-old could see through that, actually.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. But again, you mentioned the president. The shame of Obama is that Obama, he's a smart guy. He understands the dangers of nuclear power. Indeed, in some of the writings, you can go to my website and you can see quotes of this. In fact, you can go online And you can see Obama address the Keene, New Hampshire Sentinel, S-E-N-T-I-N-E-L, newspaper. This is when he was running for election in 2008. And what he says, again, running for election, is that the problem with nuclear power is that, and this is Obama's words, these plants can explode and kill a lot of people. And we could and should work to have safe, clean energy rather than nuclear power. So Obama, running for office, took a very knowledgeable anti-nuclear stand. He gets into office and forget it. He's been pushing these nuclear loan guarantees.
Complete 180, right?
The guy he's most recently appointed as Secretary of the Energy, a guy named Moniz, M-O-N-I-Z, is an atomic physicist who's, he thinks nuclear is the best thing to come along since sliced bread. He was preceded by a guy named Chu, C-H-U, who came from one of these national nuclear laboratories, involved in the nuclear, deeply involved in the nuclear establishment. So when it comes to politicians, they'll often say anything.
Well, this is it. They keep coming up with these false publications. And as far as Obama's concerned, I always feel sorry for anybody who becomes the president, because their life's in jeopardy from that moment on unless they do what they're told. I don't think people really realize what they're doing when they become a president, because they then become controlled by the guys who've been in the White House forever. Don't you think?
Yeah, I understand that, you know, and I, yeah. I've long, as a journalist, have tried to study the powers behind the powers. And, you know, you... As in that movie, All the President's Men, about Watergate, you,
yes,
as an investigative reporter, you follow the money, and I have followed the money. But in this situation, I mean, Obama has to realize, as a human being, the consequences of, let's just take Fukushima and Chernobyl. Yeah. You know, we're talking about death.
Well, the thing is, on
a massive scale, and, well, for example, JASCO. Gregory Jasko was the chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission under Obama for several years. And Jasko has actually a Ph.D. in atomic physics. Mm-hmm. So he's somebody who comes out of this atomic brotherhood, so to speak, this nuclear mafia. But he, in the wake of Fukushima, insisted that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission address the, quote, lessons learned of Fukushima. And the other commissioners on the NRC, they were outraged by the suggestion. The nuclear industry went nuts that Fukushima's lessons, its consequences, its realities would be factored into any nuclear decision-making in the United States. And JASCO, who was Obama's NRC chair, was forced out as NRC chair. Now, Obama has to understand that. He has to understand that we're not just talking about typical political trade-offs, you know, where you build a highway in my district and, you know, you make a deal with this country. We're talking here, I mean, with the highest, I don't know, the goal of any... anybody in elected office is to protect life, to preserve life. We're talking about a whole different issue. And for Obama to blind himself for whatever reason, or for whatever reasons, I mean, he wasn't perfect on nuclear technology even when he was a senator, because U.S. senator or a state senator, because the Argonne National Laboratory is in Illinois. It comes out of the Manhattan Project, and it's part of this big U.S. nuclear establishment. But still, he was good, and he's kind of an intellectual, if not an intellectual. And as I say, if you go, just watch his speech before the editorial board of the Keene, New Hampshire Sentinel, you can see he understands the thing. And for Obama to go nuclear, for Obama to take the dive, it's just, to me, so, I mean, we had this president, George W. Bush, who was a knucklehead, you know, so you wouldn't be surprised. But
so we've
got
to go beyond them, don't we, Carl? This is the thing that's really annoying about it, is that we are allowing the top-heavy government to have too much control in this. And there's a fellow, I want to get to Fukushima before we end. We've only got about another 10 minutes, and I mean, we are on Fukushima, but it is the anniversary of Fukushima. And Fukushima's just this Chernobyl that just keeps going. Like, it's like there's a nuclear explosion every day.
Well, at least they did something with Chernobyl 25 years ago, or... Well, going on close to 30 years ago now, Jill. They haven't done anything with this.
Well, I got into this as an investigative reporter, actually, in the 70s. I had done I didn't know nuclear power. I mean, I knew, but I didn't know. And in the 70s, I was working for a TV station here in the New York area, WLIW-TV, pretty big public broadcasting station, and they asked me to do a piece on nuclear. So I went to one of these national nuclear laboratories, one near me, Brookhaven National Laboratory, which was set up actually in 1947 by the Atomic Energy Commission to develop civilian uses of nuclear technology. And I put the microphone in front of the scientists and I asked, what about accidents? And they assured me and the viewing public, maybe every couple of hundred years you might have a minor accident, because there's all kind of redundancies built into these nuclear power plants and so forth. Well, when the Three Mile Island accident happened that day, I was fooled by these scientists. They made an attempt to bamboozle me, and I put this crap on the air, these lies on the air, because I found in doing this book that I mentioned, Cover Up, and why the book I think is valuable. Though I wrote it 30-some-odd years ago, today is because what I decided to do, considering the snow job, considering the propaganda, was I took a scissor and I cut out segments of various reports. In fact, there's pages of reports done at Brookhaven National Laboratory, because, as I say, it was the National Nuclear Laboratory specifically set up to develop civilian uses of nuclear technology, and it did the earliest reports on the likelihood and the consequences of nuclear plant accidents. One called the WASH 740, WASH is for Washington 740. One called the WASH, this is the 1950s, one called the WASH 740 update, done in the 60s. And in WASH 740 update, a line that repeats over and over and over again, this was done in the 60s, and I reprinted in the book as a facsimile. So you're not, just looking at what I write. A reader can look at the actual documents, and it can be a handbook in terms of getting to the truth on this issue. Over and over again in WASH 740 update is the line that a major nuclear plant accident could devastate an area the size of the state of Pennsylvania. Over and over, this is 10 years before the Three Mile Island accident. It was 30 seconds from a full meltdown. It was a partial meltdown. Nearly devastated the state of Pennsylvania. So the thing is that what has happened at Fukushima, what has happened at Chernobyl, was anticipated by these people. They knew there would be these consequences. In fact, in my book Cover Up, the way I kind of thought they would play it, finally, when the consequences occurred, would be by saying that, 30,000, 40,000 people get killed in automobile accidents every year in the United States. We're just going to have to tolerate this death toll from nuclear power. But what they've done instead, and this I wouldn't have expected, is to just go to zero, to not admit 30,000 or 40,000 deaths or any deaths. They're saying, Fukushima happened. In a recent study by Stanford University, every bluefin tuna caught off California was contaminated with cesium from Fukushima, and the full load of contaminants from Fukushima hasn't hit the west coast of the U.S. yet. The toll and in fact, there's been very important studies done by Joseph Mangano and Dr. Jeanette Sherman of the Radiation Public Health Project, of thyroid disorders beginning to show up in the United States among children. I mean, that's the first tip-off of the impacts of radioactivity, thyroid malfunctions, thyroid cancer, and so on. I mean, the toll of destruction, the toll of death. Well, Einstein actually, in his book, Out of My Later Years, he wrote it in 1946, he writes about how it's not new that humanity is misled and essentially is sent off a cliff. What's new when it comes to nuclear technology is the scale of destruction, the scale of destruction. And what I'm saying, as a journalist who has gone through the literature and in cover-up, and I urge people to download it and look at the actual documents, the primary documents, these bastards knew what they were doing all along, knew that their technology is going to kill, just like the folks in the tobacco industry who spiked the cigarettes with nicotine. They knew what they were doing was murderous, and they blinded themselves to the homicidal path that they had and they are taking, and they dealt with the public, they dealt with the people by just outright deceit with Fukushima. I mean, in these pieces that I just most recently wrote on the third anniversary, calling it a big lie, which is, you know, the way the Nazis functioned with the big lie. Goebbels, the propaganda minister, loved the big lie. Here, it's the giant lie. It's the giant lie. I mean, Goebbels would be
ecstatic,
laughing in his grave as to what the nuclear propaganda operation ministry has been doing. It's just back to the Nuremberg principles. This is a crime against humanity, which needs to be, in my view, prosecuted.
Sure. Professor, what's the solution? It seems that our politicians laugh at us whenever we send them an email or a letter, and they just maybe either throw it in a trash can and laugh at us. So what's the solution?
Well, I have found, and I'm getting long in the tooth, I've been doing this kind of work for many years as an investigative reporter, challenging inequities and injustices and danger. It's interesting how sometimes you keep fighting, you keep challenging, and it's like having a cold and the fever breaks in the middle of the night. Suddenly it's all over. You know, suddenly things change. And what I suggest is the people viewing this show arm themselves with the information, get involved better, you know, as the man said a century ago in the United States, organize in groups, more effective often in groups, and fight this. And I think ultimately we will win. We must win. And groups I might suggest would be Beyond Nuclear. Just go to beyondnuclear.org, an excellent organization. The Radiation and Public Health Project, an excellent organization. The Nuclear Information and Resource Organization, an excellent organization. Greenpeace, can't get better than Greenpeace, an excellent organization. I mean, there's groups out there you can join and should join up with to fight nuclear power.
Sure.
In other countries, Greenpeace is international, but in other countries there's, including in Australia, specific national groups fighting nuclear power. But I know of, and I've done, I mentioned I did a book on toxic chemicals. I've done investigative reporting on all kind of subjects and doing this kind of work for like decades and decades and decades. And against stiff competition, nuclear power and the threat it poses to life on Earth, this is numero uno. We have to stop it, close down every nuclear plant, get our energy from safe, clean, renewable energy sources, which are here today. I mean, that's what Germany has been doing since Fukushima, closing down its nukes. It's closed down its nukes, and it's moving ahead to having 100% renewable energy in Germany. We all could do this. We all can. We could have energy we can live with.
Yes, we can. Not to use the 5-year-old mantra, but yes, we can.
Yeah, we can't really talk. We've got too much reverb.
But
something's happening.
I'm not sure how much more you want to go. We can end this here, or we can go further.
I think it's fine. I think we said all we really would have to say.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show, and we will definitely get the information out there as many platforms as I can.
It's a pleasure to be with both of you.
All right.
Thank you. Professor Grossman, thank you so much.
Pleasure being with you.